Welcome to It's a Question of Balance with Ruth Copeland. Featuring stimulating in-depth interviews with special guests from all areas of the arts. And now, here's your host for It's a Question of Balance, Ruth Copeland.
Show in which we try to explore whether we have more in common than divides us. We ask questions that matter. We avoid politics, diving into the deeper, timeless issues underlying current events, politics, and our daily lives. We balance the intellectual with the creative, featuring local, national, and international guests from the arts. The show combines a debate topic with an arts interview because I feel discussion and creativity are two of the most vital ways we engage with the world. It's all a question of balance. Right now, I'm very happy to be talking to Mick Dawson, former Royal Marines Commando, filmmaker, sailor, adventurer, world record holder, and motivational speaker. Having seen active service in the Falklands War at the age of 17 and then again in the Middle East, Mick followed his military career with the pursuit of his lifelong passion for the ocean, becoming a professional sailor, skippering luxury yachts across the globe. Simultaneously, he was looking for an exciting challenge, which took shape first in the form of a race across the Atlantic in a 21 feet long rowing boat. Successfully rowing the 3,000 miles across the mighty Atlantic Ocean with his brother Steve inspired Mick to attempt to row the fearsome North Pacific solo. His two attempts were plagued with equipment failure, but on the second attempt, Mick rowed 4,500 miles completely alone across the mighty North Pacific until a freak wave capsized his boat. And Mick battled against all the odds to escape and survive in the stormy, dark, freezing, unforgiving waters of the North Pacific. A precarious rescue operation came the following night when Mick was plucked, quite literally, from the jaws of death by a passing container ship. On this solo trip, Mick acquired amazing footage of wildlife and the ocean that was sadly lost when the boat capsized. His dream of making a film about rowing the ocean was only strengthened, though, and he went to film school before his next two-man row from Choshi in Japan to the iconic span of the Golden Gate Bridge in San Francisco. A world first, Mick Dawson and Chris Martin are the first and only people ever to successfully row almost 7,000 miles across the North Pacific Ocean into San Francisco. They are the world record holders. Armed with his camera, Mick filmed the whole endeavor, and Discovery Channel subsequently produced a hugely popular documentary of this epic voyage called Rowing the Pacific, which is aired on Discovery Europe, Discovery UK, and Discovery Asia, with plans to be aired here in the States on Discovery USA. When he's not working defending shipping from Somali pirate attacks, Mick can be found on the ocean he loves, skippering yachts or presenting motivational talks to inspire others to follow their dreams. I'm really pleased he's made the time to talk to us on It's a Question of Balance. Welcome to the show, Mick.
Hi, Ruth. Thanks very much for inviting me.
Oh, you're very welcome. So I was thinking, amongst the elite of people who achieve remarkable feats, such as your world first row across the North Pacific, not many of them are making films. They're busy enough trying against all odds to achieve the seemingly insurmountable. How did you become interested in filmmaking, and what made you want to film your row as well as just achieve this amazing thing?
Well, it was a gradual progression, really. The rowing started 14 years ago now, really. I rowed the Atlantic with my brother, both ex-Royal Marines, looking for something to do in civilian street that was exciting again. Approached that with all different intentions and what would eventually sort of motivate me towards the North Pacific. But just being out on the ocean, originally on the Atlantic, and then latterly when I decided to try and become the first person solo, actually, to row the North Pacific, it just transformed the reason for me being there. It's just such an incredible place and such an incredible experience. It was all about getting the story. And all I wanted to do, really, was just come back for a day a month and tell people about it or show them. I could have stayed out there forever, which it sometimes seemed like we were. But
yes, I can imagine.
Yeah, it was just the experience of being out there transformed my impression of what it would be like. I thought it would just be an athletic challenge and something to motivate me to do it for that reason. But actually being out there and seeing, especially the North Pacific, because it's so unspoilt and so vast, it became very much about bringing the story back and showing people what an incredible part of the world it is.
Right. Now, understand that I think the first filming that you did was on your second solo trip to row the North Pacific. Can you tell us a bit about that trip and the filming that you did on that?
Yeah, I mean, I'd filmed earlier trips to a certain extent, but really, not principally to bring back the documentary, but with the second trip on the North Pacific, I knew what was out there. The 2 weeks of the previous trip before I'd gone back to Japan had given me a taste of what it was going to be like. So I went actually to film school in Brighton in the UK to get some of the skill. And I set about that whole trip, really, was about capturing the story of it. What I didn't realise was how incredible that footage would be. In the end, I'd spent 109 days at sea. On day 12, my unreliable satellite phone was damaged, so I had no communications from day 12 through to almost 4.5 months.
Wow.
The only people I ever spoke to during that time, apart from occasionally myself, was ships that were about to run me down on the VHF radio. And the filming process became like a living diary, really. I used to shave religiously, or fairly religiously, once or twice a week. I didn't want the beard thing going on. And I used to use the camera, and I would talk to the camera whilst I was actually filming myself out of shame. I thought it would give some continuity, and it allowed me to have that routine of, right, I must do a talking head documentary of the previous few days now. And of course, because I was on my own and I wasn't talking to anyone, and it is such a hostile and intimidating place to be on a large boat, let alone a small boat, it became really, really quite emotional, quite an intimate diary.
Yeah.
Sadly, towards the end of the trip, I was capsized just at the point where I thought I'd cracked it, where I thought I'd broken the back of the North Pacific, and I'd just over 1,000 miles, which in the scale of things doesn't seem like much when it's effectively a 7,000-mile row.
Right.
The downhill section back into San Francisco, the first boat ever to get into San Francisco, leaving Japan. And I was capsized in actually calm conditions, nothing like the typhoons and hurricanes I'd come through previously.
Hmm.
And I was trapped in a cabin. And the long and the short of that is I lost the film. And that, it was, I think, over 70 hours of this footage I had. Not just these video diaries, but just incredible encounters with the wildlife, from every kind of whale you could wish to meet to a pod of killer whales that effectively adopted me for a large part of the trip. And I had obtained footage that, you know, would have graced any natural history documentary. And then I'd lost it. So I'd started that trip wanting to bring the documentary back by the end of it. With the sinking, capsizing, sinking, and the loss of that footage, it was all about going back to get that story.
Yes, oh gosh, I can imagine. And I mean, when you think of somebody doing what you did, I think for some people they might imagine, you know, all support boats kind of going alongside just to make sure you're okay, but it really isn't not like that. It really is just you, right, out there alone.
Yeah. Well, I'll be honest, that's what I like about being at sea on any type of vessel. And what that breeds in general, or maybe I've got a romantic notion of it, is that everybody on that ocean, there are exceptions these days, but everybody works by the same rules and everybody looks out for each other. I quite like that. It's certainly a manner we don't have in normal life on dry land. But I can guarantee that almost every time I spoke to a vessel on VHF, which is like short range communications, when I could see a vessel, I'd just call up the unknown vessel, tell them who I was, they would speak to me almost every time. The first thing they would say was, how can we help you? And I quite like that because everybody's in this very, well, it's an incredibly vulnerable environment. We're not meant to be on top of the ocean in any kind of a vessel, if truth be told. But we are, because that's the nature of what human beings are. And possibly we're definitely not meant to be on it on a 7-metre rowing boat, as is often mentioned to me by the ship to me. But it's quite nice. Well, I loved all that. I loved the fact that you'd talk to a complete stranger you would never see the face of, but their first instinct as a fellow mariner is, how can we help? Not that you had to be in trouble, but that's just the nature. And it's a shame we can't transfer that more to everyday life on dry land.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I imagine sort of being just out in nature, it kind of clears out all the clutter that is now in our lives and sort of feels important. But at the end of the day, we are all here on this planet trying to survive and make a life that is fulfilling for us. But it's easy to lose sight of that, I think, isn't it?
It is, and that's one of the best things about getting on a rowing boat. I'd say it's one of the best things about getting on a boat anywhere, really. Most people who go to sea and sailing yachts would probably agree with me. You get all the stuff we surround ourselves with that has importance way beyond its reality go, because suddenly the important stuff automatically sets itself in front of you. You have to be safe, you have to know where you're going, what you're doing, and you literally get rid of all that clutter on a rowing boat. It's easy. That within days, all of that disappears and you exist in a different environment, and you can solve all the world's problems until the minute you get back on to dry land, and then they all land on your doorstep again. But it's a great experience that not many people can have, because in real life you can't step away from that for weeks and potentially months at a time. And I'm very grateful for that. It gives you that chance to at least get some perspective on what's important.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, if you just joined us, you're listening to It's a Question of Balance with Ruth Copland and my special guest this week, Mick Dawson, former Royal Marines Commando, filmmaker, sailor, adventurer, world record holder and motivational speaker. We'll be back after these messages.
Do you like the music from It's a Question of Balance with Ruth Copland? Have you ever wondered what the full songs sound like? Now you can find out by listening to the new EP, It's a Question of Balance Music, available from iTunes, Amazon, and itsaquestionofbalance.com.
No white horses to play the game, and I wish I knew your name. Something about you in the rain. Did I or didn't I say it's forever? Well, I know I said it, babe, it just goes nowhere. Well, we can do the things we want, we can do the things we like, but if we're taking all the time, well, I just don't think that it's right. That. I think that there's more to us than just that.
It's a Question of Balance Music. Download individual tracks or the whole EP from iTunes, Amazon, or itsaquestionofbalance.com.
Hi, I'm Casey, and I'm the second generation owner of Bookshop Santa Cruz. We pride ourselves on being Santa Cruz's community bookstore. We feature an extensive selection of new and used books, children's books and toys, gifts, cards, magazines, and games. Our knowledgeable booksellers can help you find just the right book or gift. We hope you can join us for our author events each week, featuring best-selling authors and books of local interest. And if you can't get downtown, our website has over 3.2 million titles, which ship directly to your home. We even have experts on site to help you publish your own book or family history. Come visit us downtown or at our website, bookshopsantacruz.com.
Bookshop Santa Cruz is celebrating 50 years of independent bookselling in the community that we love. Visit Bookshop Santa Cruz downtown and join in the festivities as we celebrate our customers and the books that make it all possible. Bookshop Santa Cruz, celebrating an amazing 50 years in downtown Santa Cruz.
Welcome back to It's a Question of Balance with me, Ruth Copland, and my guest this hour, Mick Dawson. So, Mick, I'm just thinking about, we were talking about your second attempt to row solo on the North Pacific, and we just got to the point where you were, you know, you capsized. I'm just wondering, how did you get rescued? That must have been pretty scary, being there alone, a little dot on the middle of the North Pacific.
It definitely wasn't the best I had at the office. As I said, it was completely out of the blue and in conditions that almost ideal conditions for rowing, really. I'd had 2 days of really strong, storms effectively. Two decaying typhoons had hit to this for me, and I'd rowed throughout that. I'd got the technique and the skills that you need to set the boat up to do it, and I had to go east whenever I could. And I'd rowed quite safely through that without any real problems. And then 24 hours later, I'd filmed everything, as I did throughout that voyage. I'd gone into my cabin to film the complete difference of 24 hours later when it was relatively flat, and there's certainly no waves, there's always a swell, and it was raining, and the rain actually flattens the sea down even more. And it created this incredible moonscape almost, or an eerie sort of otherworldly scape. It was like mist on the top of the water. It was all flattened down. I went in to get the camera specifically to capture this, to show the comparison, and the boat rolled over while I was in there. It wasn't an impact as such. It was definitely wave movement. At the time, I remember instantly thinking I'd finally got unlucky with the ships that had, on several occasions, I'd rowed from under the bows of, because at the time there was no systems available to accurately paint you on their radar so that they knew you were there all the time. And I just thought, I finally got, I've caught in the bow wave of a ship. I was actually waiting for the impact after that. But as it rolled over, I'd come into the cabin at the back of the boat, closed the hatch, but I'd closed it on the first connection. So there was it wasn't a watertight seal. During the roll, enough water got into the back of the cabin before I rapidly closed it off completely to stop the boat self-righting, which it's completely set up to do that. And the long and short of it, I ended up on the boat, came within 10 degrees, 15 degrees of sitting back up, and it would have all been fine. But it came to a halt. That extra water that was flopping around in the back cabin came to a halt, and I ended up basically settling back down. The boat was on its side, the hatch was covered, and the only way out of there was to basically go out the back hatch or the front hatch, both of which would flood the cabin completely and effectively sink me. So it was game over. I must say, even when all that was going on, and I only say this because I like to tell the story exactly as it was, I don't embellish it or try to make it seem gung-ho or brave, but it frightened me at all at the time, and most of the process I don't remember being particularly frightened. There were a couple of occasions it got quite hairy, but the fear came afterwards. I ended up in the water, or in the boat and in the water, for 2 hours, and it was quite a dramatic rescue towards the end. And it was only really when, after the event, and I was on the container ship, the Hanjin Philadelphia, that finally picked me up in the cabin, that I was, I'm not ashamed to admit it, 3 or 4 nights as we were coming back into Long Beach, I was waking up to screams when the imagination kicked in of what could have happened. During the whole event, being trapped in the cabin, I almost flipped into autopilot, and I knew exactly what I needed to do. I assessed my situation. obviously it was over. The boat was never going to be upright because I had to flood it to get out of it. And the electrics had been damaged with the water that got into the cabin. And I, much like you said, all that clutter had gone. I knew exactly the things I needed to do to stay alive. And just having that routine, which I put down to a military background, it's just a coping mechanism, I just got on with staying alive. I anticipated if I could stay alive for 4 days. I had an emergency beacon, obviously no communications as such for voice, but once that beacon went off, I had every hope that it was being received and that somebody would be able to get a vessel to my position if I could stay alive for 4 days. And I set about doing that.
Yeah. I can't imagine how a container ship, which I mean is absolutely enormous, isn't it, could find and pick up an individual man. That seems incredible in itself.
Well, yeah, I've got to say I've got the US Alaskan Coast Guard to thank for that, because as I was saying, I was expecting to be there for 4 days before somebody potentially turned up and a rescue was a possibility. The following night, I'd had to exit the cabin, which is probably one of the moments where it was slightly more hairy, because as you can imagine, to open the hatch to get out, I had to flood the cabin completely, and there's no way out. When that water's coming in, you're in it until it stops rushing in, and that was a hugely unpleasant experience, waiting to get out that door. And as I did that and got out, that was unfortunately where I lost the film. The film was in a waterproof grab bag within waterproof bags inside, and as I got out, I managed to get out with a one-man aircrew life raft, but I lost the grab bag with that filming. But I established myself outside, and as I say, still thinking 4 days, I was tied onto the side of the upturned boat, and the following night, in the dark, I heard this rumbling sound. I thought I was going to get run over by a ship. I looked up, and I'm very pleased to say the Alaskan Coast Guard had sent out C-130, I think it was, and they were flying. I like to describe it as treetop height. That's probably not very appropriate for the middle of the Pacific. And they were literally dropping flares all around me.
Oh, wow.
And they even dropped a life raft, which at the time, I was at one end of my upturned rowing boat. The rowing boat was 7 metres long, in the dark. The wind was picking up a little bit, wasn't too bad. And that life raft came so close that it was the other end of the rowing boat at one stage, and I honestly believe that they must have some system to remotely control it and guide it onto me. But apparently not. It was just the accuracy and the skill they've got in deploying safety kit. I couldn't get to it. I didn't have the nerve to. I thought I was quite secure where I was. I knew obviously they'd have a VHF in that life raft, and it was bigger, but I thought if I miss getting to that and can't get into it, and I abandon this life raft to get into it,
yeah,
gone. You know, it was pitch black. The sea was picking up, and then that boat disappeared into the distance. And several hours later, obviously, I realised if I'd picked up on the signal, a ship would be deployed for me at some point, and probably I would guess in the middle of the night, 3-4 in the night, the following day. In the morning, rather, I looked and saw navigation lights of, as I said, the Hanjin Philadelphia, a huge container ship. I thought all my problems are over then, but rescues at sea are not easy. They missed me twice. The first time they came by 100 metres away. My flare, which I purchased brand new in, or flares that I purchased brand new in Japan, the one I'd kept for when the ship came, didn't work.
Oh, no.
The wind picked. Exactly. And it was literally 100 yards away from me. I could hear them. I could smell the boat. I could see the guys running up and down the side of the ship. I had everything that you meant to have in that circumstance. A survival suit, reflective tape, whistle, torch. They missed me. Disappeared. Rescued the life raft that the coast guard dropped for me. Which was very good of them. And then they basically were redirected to come back the second time. I was 10 yards down the side of the vessel, halfway down the side of this 360-metre vessel, I think it is, and they finally saw me. And they said, "We're going too fast." I went, "Oh, well, you've got me." And the light was on me. And then as I got to the back of the ship, the container ships are vast, there was just an explosion and a wall of water about 20 feet high. Picked up the upturned rowing boat, threw it on top of me.
Oh, no.
Tore the life raft to shreds. And I found myself treading water for England, in the dark, in the Pacific, as the Hanjin disappeared again into the distance to do this major evolution to turn round and come back for the third time. By that stage, I'd crawled onto the upturned hull of the rowing boat and I was hanging onto the rudder. But it was, from going like it's going very well under the circumstances, it had got much less so.
Yeah.
The third time, German captain called Peter Winter, the master of the vessel, did all the crew, did a fantastic job across the board. The US Coast Guard are unbelievable. I owe my life to them. And I certainly, you know, that expands to the guys on the ship. They came back the third time and I was run down. The only way you could get it close to me was to literally run me down with the bow of the container ship. Admittedly, at a drifting speed, he didn't have the engines on.
Right.
And I bounced down the side of the vessel, and they got a pilot ladder down, the wooden rope ladder that goes down the side of the vessel, and I managed. They got a line down to me eventually, slowed the boat down enough, or my boat, so that we were going at the same speed, and I sadly leapt off my rowing boat. I had one Atlantic crossing on, and the best part of over two-thirds of the way across the North Pacific, and sadly had to leap off onto the pilot ladder and leave the vessel and all that footage inside of her.
Oh, it must have been.
The only injury, really, I got from that whole experience was, as I got onto the ladder, the wave was picking the boat up and down at the side of the container, and it trapped. The boat came up and trapped my leg onto the ladder. It was no major injury. It was a bit of a bruise and a cut on my shin. But I took that as a, where are you going? You know, like a goodbye kiss and what do you think you're doing leaving me here? But, yeah, it's quite a poignant moment. But, I mean, under the circumstances, the fact that I had my life, it's churlish to regret losing that footage. But
yeah.
I'd be lying to you if I didn't admit that, you know, to this day I regret losing that footage.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's all in your mind, but you can't share it with anyone. And, you know, it sounds as if you saw some amazing things in terms of wildlife in the ocean and experiences you were having. So I'm just thinking, I think if my life was at risk or someone I loved, their life was at risk, you know, I could attempt something like these rows. Mentally, I think I could. Physically, I'm not sure if I would be able to. But there's no way I would ever think, oh, I fancy doing that. I'm just wondering, you know, especially after such a, you know, dramatic rescue and it becoming very clear, you know, that death is very close, doing something like this. What made you want to attempt the row across the North Pacific that, you know, broke the world record? You know, something so dangerous and also to put yourself through such hardship, because, I mean, it's grueling, isn't it? I know on that row with Chris Martin, you basically did 2 hours on and 2 hours off for 189 days. Is that right?
Yeah. Well, there are gaps on the Pacific because it's attritional. So you've got times when you literally can't row. You're in the face of a storm, or even 10 or 15 knots will stop you going in the right direction. But yeah, every hour we could row of every day, we rowed 2 hours on, 2 hours off. We even spoke about it afterwards. Because we're highly self-critical. What could we have done better? And we worked out the maximum in 6.5 months at sea that we didn't row when we could have done was probably 12 hours or six shifts.
Wow.
And we were that religious on getting out there. I mean, if you go onto any ocean in a rowing boat, your first priority is to get off it at the other side as quick as you can.
So back to my question, why are you on it in the first place? What makes you want to do something so dangerous and involving so much hardship?
Well, the hardship's the price you pay for the experience, and the experience, without doubt, every one of my rows, every single day of every one of my rows has been the best experience, some of the best experiences of my life. So you accept the hardships. I think for me, probably, if it goes back to my family, that I had a family that brought me up to give me the confidence to go out and try to do something important, something that matters. And so I had that confidence. At 16, I joined the Marines. At 17, I was in the Falklands War. And that experience, not that I would recommend anyone goes to war, it's unfortunate, but it happens. And if you join the Marines, that's ultimately what you hope to be involved in, to see if you are capable of doing your job and how you act. As wrong as that may sound to some people, that is the nature of young men. And I think I came back from that experience. And the phrase I use for it is the colours are brighter when you think you might be looking at them for the last time. And I think there's an element of coming back from my times in the Marines that life was so intense that it was more colourful than normal life. So I've got this thing in me that, and I know lots of people that have got it, that want to do things that make life that much more intense, and that do something that matters. And every minute I've been on a Ryan on the North Pacific matters. You're not cruising at any point. You know, you're constantly fighting a battle to achieve your goal in one way or another. And I like that intensity. We need that intensity to get the best out of me.
Yeah. And I know that you, after this epic row, you almost missed San Francisco at the end. That was your sort of end point. But it's quite difficult to get into San Francisco, isn't it, I think? In a rowing boat.
It's difficult to get in anywhere in a rowing boat. That was the whole point of the trip. In that sense, in the achievement of doing it, beyond the documentary, the principle was to show that we could navigate a route in a rowing boat from Choshi in Japan to San Francisco, directly beneath the Golden Gate Bridge. Not to hit America, that's been proved before. This was to show that we could get into that spot so that we could, that route is doable. And no one had ever done it before. I doubt anyone will ever do it again because of what's involved. Mm. And 24 hours out, if you'd have asked me, I was not sure we would get in. I thought we would be pushed too far south. And the last 6 weeks, when I capsized and sank and I thought I was on the downhill bit if I'd gone beyond that, the last 6 weeks was harder than anything, any part of that voyage before. And getting away from Japan is a nightmare in itself and all sorts of challenges and difficulties to overcome. But that last 6 weeks, if you can imagine, we'd lost 25 kilos plus each in body weight. We'd gone from 6,000 calories a day down to 400 before we ran out of food within sight of the coast. Just the attritional nature of what we'd done physically, where we were at that stage. And then we were dealing with the fact that we were slightly slower than we'd hoped. And we were dealing with winter. We were October and November. It was November the 13th we got in. So we've got cold. The storms are getting bigger and longer. We were pretty much, physically, we were all over the rowing in that sense. But with the best will in the world, we had to be weaker and more susceptible to injury. And everything that could go against us was going against us. And we were, I remember it vividly, we were fighting our way through currents. We were trapped and sent back and having to row through currents again before the wind changed and sent us back. And one point crossing one place three times before we finally left it behind us. And then we were off Point Reyes. And I was on the phone, on the satellite phone, that fortunately that trip worked. Chris was rowing outside. It was night. And I was actually asking the guys who'd come over from the UK, if we need a tow, can you sort one out? Because I'm horrible if we're going to get pushed too far south. And the feel of the boat changed, and I could hear Chris running hollering outside, and I stuck my head outside. We were on the front of about 25 knot winds, following seas, all lit up in phosphorescence like nothing I've ever seen at sea. And Chris just goes to me, the wind's come round. And the wind had come round about 35 degrees. It hadn't been forecast, but it had come round to exactly what we needed to get as close into Point Reyes as we could. And I'm not superstitious or sentimental, but I can promise you, me and Chris both said that's the Pacific saying to us, go on, you've
earned it.
Done everything I've asked. You've earned it. This is your chance.
Yeah.
Because we were gone if that wind hadn't changed. But once we got past that point, then we still had 30 miles to get into San Francisco, but we felt then that we were going to crack it.
Yeah. It must have been a euphoric feeling when you finally arrived.
You know what?
Or relief.
The feeling was that when that wind changed. When we arrived, it was surreal.
Yes.
Because we'd had a day, fantastic day actually. I'm so grateful for that day of basically doing a coastal row to the point where we would get in. So we had 24 hours with all the pressure off that we'd had for six and a half months before, because we honestly felt that we're going to get in now. So we had that 24 hours where me and Chris could enjoy it properly. We
yeah.
had the whole trip in a way, but we could really enjoy it and savour it, because the second you get in, you're surrounded by people, and your families rightly take you away. They, you know, they want you back, and you're separated. And that team that we've become, and that's a key point for the trip for me. We became the best maritime team of the last 100 years in my eyes. You know,
yes.
I can't believe I was part of two people who could do that. Chris is the world's best partner. He couldn't have done the job any better, and I don't know anyone who could have done the job any better than him.
No.
But the moment you get in, you're away. That's 6.5 months of just you and that one guy on a space on a boat the size of a large dining room table. That team's gone.
Yes.
You've no longer got those pressures on you. So that last 24 hours, rowing in, listening to, we could even get radio. We could get the local easy listening channel. So we had some Dean Martin and the Eagles to listen to. You can't imagine what that sounds like when you've only had the entertainment you took with you.
Yeah. I can imagine. That was
a euphoric bit. Being under the bridge was almost like it was surreal. Even now, I can hardly believe that happened, really.
Yeah, amazing. Well, if you just joined us, I'm talking to my guest of this hour, Mick Dawson, talking here about his world record-holding trip from Japan to San Francisco. If you want more information about Mick, you can go to the website 189days.com, and that's 189 as numerals.com. Find out more about the trip and about Mick. We're going to go to a break now, but keep it here on It's a Question of Balance with Ruth Copeland.
Ciao. I'm Luca from Tramonti at 528 Seabright Avenue, steps from the ocean. We are the authentic Italian pizza and pasta restaurant, serving also organic salad and house-made dessert in a friendly family-style atmosphere, indoor or on our lovely patio.
Tramonti is open every day from noon to 9 and later on Fridays and Saturdays. Come enjoy our specials every Tuesday neighborhood night and the best deal for a healthy bite at lunch every day.
We bake our bread and prep our fresh pasta and pizza daily. Beppe, Danielle and I want to say grazie to the Santa Cruz community for supporting us in the past 2 years. Allora, buon appetito!
Visit Luca and Beppe at Tremonti, 528 Seabright Avenue. That's Tremonti, 528 Seabright Avenue.
Can you imagine living without stress, anxiety, or fear? And can you imagine a life filled with harmony and inner peace? Is that even possible? The Ananda Yoga and Meditation Center in Scotts Valley offers simple tools to help you become more effective at work and more centered in the face of life's challenges. At Ananda, we offer yoga classes for everybody, inspiring workshops, devotional chanting, and Sunday services based on the teachings of Paramahansa Yogananda. Our teachers and therapists are highly trained professionals who work together to inspire a healthier you. And your first Ananda yoga class is always free. Visit us at anandascottsvalley.org or call 338-YOGA. That's anandascottsvalley.org or 338-YOGA.
This portion of the show is sponsored by Dina Scopatoni, who is an award-winning fashion model, academic teaching modern art history at Cabrillo College, and Vogue fashion photographer. An ocular centrist, Dina's photographs range from fashion editorials to soul-catching portraits to evocative documentary images. The vibrant nature of her work evokes the glamour of Mario Testino, Annie Leibovitz in Helmut Newton, while expressing an understanding of composition and contrast which is all her own. Trained as an art historian at the University of London's esteemed Courtauld Institute, Dina Scopatoni looks for the intellectual and visual contrasts in each of her photographs. If you're interested in viewing her wonderful work, you can go to dinascopatoni.com. That's dinascopatoni.com.
Welcome. Welcome back to It's a Question of Balance with me, Ruth Copland. And I just wanted to remind you that if you want more information on the show or to listen to previous shows, you can go to the website, itsaquestionofbalance.com. And you can also follow me on Twitter, at Ruth Copland. Friend me on Facebook, ruth.copland.1, or connect on LinkedIn. And this hour, as you know, if you've been listening, but if you've just tuned in, we're talking to Mick Dawson about his world first row with Chris Martin from Japan all the way to San Francisco, nearly 7,000 miles. And also about the film that he made about that, which has been broadcast by the Discovery Channel called Rowing the Pacific. And hopefully that's going to be out in America soon. It's been in Asia and Europe and the UK, been very popular. So I wanted to ask you, Mick, as well. You've had a very interesting life in lots of different ways, and obviously these amazing feats that you've achieved. But I was thinking, with the success of the film Captain Phillips, the desperate situation of both shipping and the pirates was brought home to the kind of wider populace. And I know you like adventure, but how did you come to be defending ships against pirates, which I know you did for a while after your row?
Yeah, it kind of makes a lie of what I said earlier about everybody at sea wanting to help each other. I tend to think...
with a few exceptions.
Yeah, that's the land mentality creeping out onto the sea. Basically, I came back from the end of the row, and I didn't want to go back to sea again on a yacht, because that meant being away from home too much. And as luck would have it... as bad luck would have it for some people, the piracy threat had snowballed, and a lot of my former colleagues and friends were setting up companies that were putting armed security onto ships to defend against the piracy threat in the Indian Ocean, and I spent a couple of years doing that, which was actually, the Captain Phillips film's pretty good. I think that's a fairly, for a movie, that's a fairly good representation of exactly what it's like. What it was like, to be honest, really. It's been sorted to some degree now, I think.
Yes, yeah. I mean, it's hard to imagine the desperation that's driving people to do that, but also the fear, I imagine, that the people on the shipping vessels must feel of this threat of attack.
Yeah, that's the one thing. I like to think I've got a balanced view on things. And the one thing I did realise as soon as I got there, on a number of ships we were on, the crew, it's invariably Filipino crew predominantly, or Indian or Sri Lankan. The amount of times we were thanked as a team for being on there, because there were numerous hijackings and hundreds of people being held hostage at one stage. And I certainly met individuals who had been held hostage, and they were traumatised by it, and they would come up and thank us on behalf of their family, because they then felt safe, you know, crossing those waters. But on the flip side of that, you also get to know about why the Somalians are doing that. And there's, you know, I did actually hope to get into Somalia at the time to film a documentary from their perspective as well. There's an argument for what was happening to them as well. It snowballed, obviously. Terrorist organisations and major crime got involved as it escalated, and the amount of money on offer. But ultimately, it's poor people trying to film, trying to feed the families, that led to fishermen going out to sea to tax, as they called it, ships in the first place.
Yeah.
So it's never cut and dry. Any sort of conflict like that or situation, there's always two sides to the argument. But from my point of view, it was about stopping people harming the crew and the ships that we were working on. So it was morally, acceptable.
Yeah, that would be an interesting film, I would think. You know, you having been actually on a ship, you know, as security defending it, and then to go into Somalia and show the other side. I hope you get to make that sometime.
Yeah, it has a few insurance issues, apparently.
I can imagine.
The situation has changed now, but I just think it's a fascinating story, and it's so easy to see it always from one side.
Yeah,
you know. So it would have been nice to have got a more balanced view on it. But yeah, hopefully the situation's sorted out to some degree now, and it's certainly not the threat it was 2 or 3 years ago.
Yeah. Do you have any more films in mind that you would like to make?
Yeah, I'd love to go back to Nigeria. There's a charity that we raise money for, Chris and I raise money for, called the Hearts of Gold Hospice in Nigeria. Incredible, one of the most incredible women I've ever met, Teresa. She set up a hospice that basically rescues handicapped Nigerian children. And it's a desperate situation, but poverty breeds desperation. And there are literally children with handicaps being thrown onto rubbish dumps and left to die as babies, as young children. And she dedicated her life after having an accident and praying to keep her leg. And keeping her leg, she walked out of the hospital and said, right, I said I'd dedicate my life to help these kids. And she set up this amazing two-bedroom bungalow, basically, when I knew her. She had 49 children in there with everything from autism to obviously AIDS and most shockingly of all for me, thalidomide. Kids with thalidomide because the unregulated access to medicines. And she was just incredible. You know, puts everything into perspective. And one of the things I'd really like to do is just show her story. A, to highlight the plight of these kids, and B, just to showcase what an incredible person she is and the people that work for her. You know, it was a humbling experience to know her, and it's a story that deserves to be told.
Yeah, well, I hope you get to make that film. And we're coming towards the end of the show, so I did also just want to touch on your work as a motivational speaker. And I've been fortunate enough to attend two of your talks, which were great. And I'm just wondering, what motivates you to want to share your experiences in this way?
Well, the key thing is, a lot of people will look at what I did, and they probably rightly, and say it's quite a selfish endeavour. You know, especially the stress it puts on your family members. You know, my parents went through hell for years. Probably thought when the military time stopped, it would end. But then both their sons going across the Atlantic and the North Pacific, you know, pretty much nearly dying on one occasion. So it is, I can see that. But what I wanted to prove is that it's ultimately you can give something back. And telling the story and, you know, explaining the adventure, it's a positive thing. You know, it's especially with children, with young people, it immediately broadens our horizon. Years ago, I had an English teacher who came back after the summer holidays, and the first thing he did was showed us slides then of him climbing Mont Blanc, and that has stayed with me. That adventure that he shared with us stayed with me, and I'm sure it's shaped my choices in the future. Mm. And I hope that by telling my story that I can do something, give something positive back.
Yeah.
I had a young man quite recently actually came to a series of my talks on a cruise liner. He was 12 years old, just after the 2009 row. He came with his grandparents to me, and he said, very shyly, he said, I'm going to row across the Atlantic one day, having listened to your lectures.
Aww.
And this previous February, he became the youngest person in the world ever to row across an ocean.
Wow.
Now, I think that, you know, any level of selfishness that may well be involved in what I've done, that all goes back there. That's so positive for me that can have, you know, on no doubt he would have gone on to doing remarkable things anyway, but it was a catalyst to get him thinking about that. And I think that's the power of sharing those experiences.
You know, to make you feel that you, whatever your dreams are, which may not be, you know, rowing the ocean, but if you really go for it, that you can achieve that. And
it's about passion. If you put passion into your life, whatever that is, it doesn't have to be the extreme level that I did, because I was passionate about going to sea in a rowing boat. But if you put passion into your life, and we've all got it, there's something that flicks your switch where you're passionate about it. All that equates to is you've got fuel. It's energy, and you'll have a bottomless supply of energy to achieve that goal. And it doesn't have to be rowing across the Pacific. It can be painting, it can be writing, it can be having a family. It can be something that you want to do, but you just need to have the confidence to pursue it. And hopefully by me, as somebody not particularly remarkable, but who arguably has done something remarkable, they can see that anybody can do that.
Yeah.
And, you know, you can put that passion into your life, which, as far as I've always seen, people who have got that in the life, it's a positive thing. And it'll pay back the US Coast Guard, who so kindly rescued me, and they'll see the positivity in what I was doing, which I know with these kind of adventures, people can sometimes be critical of.
Oh, right. Well, what inspires me about your role is the courage you had to put yourself in a new situation and be open to what you could learn about yourself. And I think, you know, that's also what makes it transferable to your story, transferable to so many different experiences in life, you know, whether it be business or school or anything that you're trying to achieve. You know, that idea of just having that courage to take that step, to put yourself in a unknown situation and then be open to what you can learn. And we got a couple of minutes left. Could you tell me what you think you learned about yourself briefly?
What I learned about myself, probably the solo row taught me everything that I wanted to know, because that was probably the most challenging thing that I've ever done. It wasn't the hardest thing. I was probably more equipped to deal with that solo row. The hardest thing I ever did was a 16-year-old joining the Marines. That
right.
That learning curve was far greater than getting onto a rowing boat, having had a lifetime of sailing. And what probably the best thing I learned was doing the row with Chris, because I never thought I could be part of a team that could be that successful. We never rowed. We had a couple of little not talking, let's just stay quiet moments, but 6.5 bumps on a vessel the size of a dining table, and we didn't really have a cross word. And when we set out, I was very conscious of the dynamics on the boat. I said to Chris in Japan, mate, this is the routine will work. This is why I'm planning this route. Are you happy with that? And Chris sat there and he went, Mick, that's all fine, mate. He said, all I care about is when we get off the boat, we can shake hands and we're still mates. Mm. And I know you'll have seen the picture. There's a picture somebody was kind enough to take directly beneath the centre of the Golden Gate Bridge. And I'm at the front of the boat. Chris is a stroke because he was a proper rower. And there's a handshake above both our heads right under the centre of the Golden Gate Bridge.
Oh, brilliant.
We came off, we weren't mates at the end of that, we were brothers, you know, and that's probably the best thing I learned, that I would not have thought I'd have been capable of being part of a team as good as that. And that experience is worth the sinking and not making it and all the disappointment to share that experience with somebody else, because any experience shared is you know, the value is so much greater.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad you were able to capture that in your film, Rowing the Pacific, and we'll look out for that here in America. Hopefully Discovery will be putting it on soon. But if listeners want to find out more about Mick and all his endeavours, you can go to the website 189days.com. That's the numerals, 189days.com. And thank you so much, Mick, for making the time to come and talk to us on It's a Question of Balance. You've had a remarkable life and it's very inspiring, and I appreciate you taking the time out to tell us about it.
My pleasure. Thank you very much for inviting me.
Oh, you're very welcome. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
So, bye-bye. So I just wanted to remind you once more, if you want more information on the show, you can go to itsaquestionofbalance.com. You can listen to past shows there. This interview will also be podcasted there. If ever you miss a show, you can always find it on the website. So check out those details on the website. This is It's a Question of Balance with Ruth Copland. Have a great night.